right? And so we're trying to move away from this systemic humiliation to a dignity economy that supports people, that gives them more of that access that I'm speaking to. But the party or the individual or the political organization which demonstrates a way up for people out of Mississippi is who I believe ultimately could obtain the loyalty of the people of Mississippi, because neither party, you know, if you take Republican leadership, Republican leadership has taken for granted that Mississippi will always vote Republican. And so there's no need to do anything to support or to benefit Mississippi in any special way. If you take Democratic leadership, they've looked at Mississippi as a strong red state where there's no opportunity to progress. And I think we have to abandon that idea. Just by the demographics alone, it suggests that if the proper interest or the proper consideration of Mississippi was laid, that there's opportunity to develop, there's opportunity to see a different trajectory for the national politics, political scene.
We know Attorney General Jeff Sessions has doubled down on the war on drugs, so-called war on drugs. We also know the impacts it's had, especially on African Americans, fueling mass incarceration, the problems with recidivism, voter disenfranchisement, which I mentioned earlier, is a huge problem, including in the South. What's your position on the war on drugs? We know the opioid epidemic has become a national in the national headlines now, and it's affecting, you know, all types of populations. Mm-hmm. But do you think those policies need to be addressed as well? And what's happening on the local level, Jackson?
I really don't believe that anyone can make the argument that we have sound drug policy in our country, right? So it's obvious that it has to be addressed. The opioid epidemic is real. You know, we're seeing things in our communities that we hadn't seen before. Just a complete erosion of a moral compass, and you know, things that these drugs are bringing out of people, and so it's problematic. People are literally killing themselves. But we also have to confront the obvious contradictions within our society about what we criminalize and what we, you know, decide to give a slap on the wrist and how imbalanced it is. And what the drug epidemic demonstrates is a criminal justice system which is out of hand. You know, we have a criminal justice system which is all about the criminal industry. You know, people have said, and I think I mentioned this in my discussion yesterday, people have said that crime doesn't pay. The reality is crime pays very well, right? If we look at all of the people who are employed by crime each and every day in our society, we have to acknowledge that if crime stopped tomorrow, our economy would crash. And so you have the police. You have more police today than you've ever had. You have your city police, your county police, your state police, your federal police, your secret police. Your secret police, who watch the secret police, right? You have your judges. You have your lawyers. You have people who contract with the prisons. So all of these people whose occupation, whose livelihood is dependent on crime, means that a necessary part of that is the overcriminalization of our society. And if there was a connection between over-incarceration or over-policing and the reduction of crime, we would have the lowest crime numbers on the planet. But yet we have more police than any other place on Earth. We have more people incarcerated than any other place on Earth. And we have more crime than any other place on Earth. And so we have to look at holistic solutions to crime. We have to attack the conditions which lead to crime, because you can't out-police it.
I wanted to ask you about wages, which ties into all of this. I saw a recent article in the Clarion Ledger that says a starting Walmart or Sam's Club employee earns a higher salary than a host of employees in Jackson City government. Mm-hmm. And you're taking some actions around that. Can you talk
Absolutely.
About what you're doing?
So when we took office, not only do we see people within the city who have received, you know, egregiously low wages, there actually was a furlough taking place. You have people who hadn't received pay raises in 11 years. And so in our budget, though it's not where we want it to be, we took immediate action, under the, the advice of many of our directors to raise the hourly wage of people within our public works and parks and rec department. And we're looking to increase that even more. And we felt that we had to eliminate that furlough immediately, which we did. Not only was it not demonstrating dignity and respect for our city employees, it was not good fiscal management for the city. As we had cut government, our revenue as a city had begun to decline. And so it wasn't even beneficial. And what we see is that when you put more money in the hands of the people who live and work in the city, then the city stands a greater chance of receiving more of that money back. And that's more than just a theory. That's something that was tested out under my father's work as a city council person. My father argued for pay raises for the city employees each and every year that he was on council. The final year that my father was on council, the mayor relented and put away $1 million in a bonus for city employees just for that year. The next year, we saw a boost of $3 million in the city revenue, and we knew it was directly correlated to that decision because we had declining revenue each year previous. And so it makes sense in terms of demonstrating appreciation for labor, and it makes sense for our economy. We're talking about soliciting businesses. We're talking about the tax cuts and the benefits that we provide to businesses, right? What goes further towards stimulating your economy is putting money in the hands of the people who shop in your cities each and every day, who buy gas, who buy groceries and all of the things that they need. That stimulates the economy much quicker than providing something to companies who are looking to shave, off of the dollars that they spend each and every day and hoard more.
We've had a lot of economists on that have studied the numbers, and they would agree with you that is the best and direct way to stimulate the economy, to increase revenue, things like spending on education, not to mention that the cost of incarcerating someone is in some places twice as high as putting them through a year of college. Yeah. So that money could be better spent somewhere.
Absolutely. We should invest more in attacking the causes that lead to incarceration and really identifying that there's something amiss in our society. If it has not succeeded for us, then we can't continue to walk through this wall and continue to fund the things that have not demonstrated better success rates in terms of the reduction in crime, have not demonstrated, as we talk about what we fund and what we incentivize, that have not demonstrated greater returns for wealth within our communities.
So you're a Democrat. I'll give you a chance to talk about that. But you are a registered Democrat.
Yeah, I am a registered member of the Freedom Democratic Party. Which I actually got my card from Holmes County, where the Freedom Democratic Party was organized at that time.
And nationally, the Democratic Party is experiencing some would call a civil war between different factions, fighting over the future, the lessons of the 2016 election. Democrats have faced a number of defeats on a statewide and national level in recent years. Where do you see your brand of politics fitting in into the left, into the Democrats nationally?
I'm left of the left. I'm revolutionary. Mm-hmm. Where I see it, I think that people, whether you look at the election of Trump or if you consider the election of the youngest mayor in Jackson's history who accepts the term that or the label that has been placed on me of radical, what that indicates is people want something different, right? There's an energy surfacing, and what we have to do is concretize it. We have to take it from that mystical, that mysterious place and bring forth policies which are real to people, that they can see a true shift from what they've been seeing historically. We have to recognize the failures of our leadership on both ends of the spectrum. You know, Mississippi is the best test case scenario of that, that what has been happening to date has not worked to the benefit of people in my state. And I would imagine it hasn't worked to the benefit of people throughout the country. And so we have to hear, we have to be aware or we have to we have to make certain that we don't miss what is being said amongst people throughout the country. And that's why they're making these radical choices. And you know, it's okay, like I said, to have a radical idea. But being radical doesn't necessarily mean reckless, right? And what we're seeing is recklessness from our national office. We need to still take pragmatic approaches to the things that we want to see changes, where we want to see change. But we have to dare to address our inherent contradictions. We have to dare to say, look, our criminal justice system is out of hand. We have to dare to say our economic policy isn't you know, working to change conditions for the everyday person. And we're seeing the same generational poverty. We have to dare to move to more green industry. We have to dare to address things that if we follow the numbers, if we follow the data, it demonstrates what will have a greater impact on things such as poverty. There's a greater correlation between commute time and transportation to generational poverty than even crime and education. Mm-hmm. Right. And so we have to make certain that we listen and take heed and make the necessary changes.
And finally, the role and importance of women leading in your administration and the impact that's had.
Absolutely. So my chief of staff, Dr. Safia Omari, often we have conversations about gender equity and the importance. Just as I call out spaces or people who demonstrate implicit bias or explicit bias in terms of race, I have to recognize that, you know, I, as a man, am sexist, right? Now, that's not what I intend to be, right? But I have to recognize that in my space, I cannot tell a woman what is and what is not sexist, right? And so I have to be willing to hear and to adjust my behavior so that I lead out of my sexist behavior. And that's important. That's important so that we can serve ourselves better, that we truly create a society beyond contradiction that gives or acknowledges that women have not had the same opportunity historically that men have. One of my favorite authors, and it's because my wife actually pointed me to her, is Dr. Chimamanda Adichie, who wrote a book, We Should All Be Feminists. And she spoke to how our decision not to uplift and by limiting the women in our lives, how it drastically impacts and limits us all. And so I think that's an important thing. And I would encourage everybody to read Chimamanda Adichie's book. And so I am a sexist man that chooses and wants not to be that way. I am proud to say that I'm a feminist. Yeah.
All right. Chokwe Antar Lumumba, mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we'll be following up with you in the coming weeks and months. We'll be traveling down to Jackson and seeing firsthand the work you're implementing and what you hope to achieve.
We look forward to having you. We hope that you enjoy your stay. Look forward to fruitful discussion. And we're excited about the direction that our city is going in.
We want to thank our viewers for watching us on Facebook, YouTube, and on our website. And a reminder, we're in the midst of our winter fundraising drive. So please go to our website and donate today so we can keep these conversations going. Thank you so much for joining us.
And now journalist Chris Hedges talks about fascism in the age of Trump.
It really is communities like this, especially given the times we're about to face, that are going to sustain it, us. Because when things get bad, the elites will retreat into their gated compounds with amenities and services and security that's denied to the rest of us, and they'll leave us on our own. And we are, you know, as Martin Buber understood, it is for those of us who endure, it is going to be a complete inversion of the values of the consumer culture, which I'm going to speak about, and it really is going to be, we are going to be, our not only our integrity, but our ability to endure will be measured by our capacity to sustain our neighbor. And that's really what Sanctuary is about, which is why I'm thrilled to be here and why I admire the work you do so much. The American Empire is coming to an end. The U.S. economy is being drained by wars in the Middle East and vast military expansion across the globe. It is burdened by growing deficits, along with the devastating effects of deindustrialization and global trade agreements. Our democracy has been captured and destroyed by corporations that steadily demand more tax cuts, more deregulation, and impunity from prosecution for massive acts of financial fraud, all the while looting trillions from the U.S. Treasury in the form of bailouts. The nation has lost the power and respect needed to induce allies in Europe, Latin America, Asia, and Africa to do its bidding. Add to this the mounting destruction caused by climate change, and you have a recipe for an emerging dystopia. Overseeing this descent at the highest levels of the federal and state governments is a motley collection of imbeciles, con artists, thieves, opportunists, and warmongering generals. And yes, I am also speaking about the Democratic Party. The empire will limp along, steadily losing influence, until the dollar is dropped as the world's reserve currency, plunging the United States into a crippling depression and instantly forcing a massive contraction of our military machine. Short of a sudden and widespread popular revolt, which does not seem likely, the death spiral appears unstoppable, meaning the United States as we know it will no longer exist within a decade, or at most two. The global vacuum we leave behind will be filled by China, already establishing itself as an economic and military juggernaut. Or perhaps there will be a multipolar world carved up among Russia, China, India, Brazil, Turkey, South Africa, and a few other states. Or maybe the void will be filled, as the historian Alfred McCoy writes, by a collection of transnational corporations, multilateral military forces like NATO, and an international financial leadership, self-selected at Davos and Bilderberg, that will forge a supranational nexus to supersede any nation or empire. Under every measure, from financial growth and infrastructure investment to advanced technology, including supercomputers, space weaponry, and cyber warfare, we are being rapidly overtaken by the Chinese. In April 2015, the U.S. Department of Agriculture predicted that the American economy would grow by nearly 50% over the next 15 years, while China's economy is predicted to triple and come close to surpassing America's by 2030. China became the world's second largest economy in 2010, the same year it became the world's leading manufacturing nation, pushing aside a United States that had dominated the world's manufacturing for a century. The Department of Defense issued a sober report. At our own peril, DOD risk assessment in a post-primacy world. It found that the U.S. military, and I quote, no longer enjoys an unassailable position versus state competitors, and it no longer can automatically generate consistent and sustained local military superiority at range. McCoy predicts the collapse will come by 2030. Empires in decay embrace an almost willful suicide. Blinded by their hubris and unable to face the reality of their diminishing power, they retreat into a fantasy world where hard and unpleasant facts no longer intrude. They replace diplomacy, multilateralism, and politics with unilateral bombastic threats and the blunt instrument of war. This collective self-delusion saw the United States make the greatest strategic blunder in its history, one that sounded the death knell of the empire, the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. The architects of the war in the George W. Bush White House and the array of useful idiots in the press and academia who were cheerleaders for it knew very little about the countries being invaded, were stunningly naive about the effects of industrial warfare, and were blindsided by the ferocious blowback. They stated and probably believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, although there was no valid evidence to support this claim. They insisted that democracy would be implanted in Baghdad and spread across the Middle East. They assured the public that U.S. troops would be greeted by grateful Iraqis and Afghans as liberators. They promised that oil revenues would cover the cost of reconstruction. They insisted that bold and quick military strikes, shock and awe, would restore American hegemony in the region and dominance in the world. But it did the opposite. As Zbigniew Brzezinski noted, this unilateral war of choice against Iraq precipitated a widespread delegitimation of U.S. foreign policy. Historians of empire call these military fiascos a feature of all late empires, micromilitarism. The Athenians engaged in micromilitarism when during the Peloponnesian War they invaded Sicily, suffering the loss of 200 ships and thousands of soldiers and triggering revolts throughout the empire. Britain did this in 1956 when it attacked Egypt in a dispute over the nationalization of the Suez Canal and then quickly had to withdraw in humiliation, empowering a string of Arab nationalist leaders such as Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser, and dooming British rule over the nation's few remaining colonies. Neither of these empires recovered. While rising empires are often judicious, even rational, in their application of armed force for conquest and control of overseas dominions, fading empires are inclined to ill-considered displays of power, dreaming of bold military masterstrokes that would somehow recoup lost prestige and power, McCoy writes. Often irrational, even from an imperial point of view, these micro-military operations can yield hemorrhaging expenditures or humiliating defeats that only accelerate the process already underway. But empires need more than force to dominate other nations. They need a mystique. This mystique, always a mask for imperial plunder, repression, and exploitation, seduces some native elites who become willing to do the bidding of the imperial power or at least remain passive. And it provides a patina of civility, even nobility, to justify to those at home the costs in blood and money needed to maintain empire. The parliamentary system of government that Britain replicated in appearance in its colonies, and the introduction of British sports such as polo, cricket, and horse racing, along with the elaborately uniformed viceroys and the pageantry of royalty, were buttressed by what the colonials said was the invincibility of their navy and their army. And England was able to hold its empire together from 1815 to 1914 before being forced into a steady retreat. America's high-blown rhetoric about democracy, liberty, and equality, along with basketball, baseball, and Hollywood, as well as our own deification of the military, entranced and cowed much of the globe in the wake of World War II. Behind the scenes, of course, the CIA used its bag of dirty tricks to orchestrate coups, fix elections, and carry out assassinations, black propaganda campaigns, bribery, blackmail, intimidation, and, of course, torture. But none of this works anymore. The photographs of physical abuse and sexual humiliation imposed on Arab prisoners at Abu Ghraib inflamed the Muslim world. It fed Al-Qaeda and later ISIS with recruits. The assassination of Osama bin Laden, he was unarmed, it's called assassination, and a host of other jihadist leaders, including the U.S. citizen Anwar al-Awlaki, openly mocked the concept of the rule of law. The hundreds of thousands of dead and millions of refugees fleeing our debacles in the Middle East, along with the near constant threat from militarized aerial drones, exposed us as state terrorists. We have replicated in the Middle East the U.S. military's penchant for widespread atrocities, indiscriminate violence, lies, and fatal miscalculations that led to our defeat in Vietnam. The brutality abroad is matched by a growing brutality at home. Militarized police gun down mostly unarmed, poor people of color, and fill a system of penitentiaries and jails that hold a staggering 25% of the world's prisoners, although Americans represent only 5% of the global population. Many of our cities are in ruins. Our public transportation is in shambles. Our educational system is in steep decline and being privatized. Opioid addiction, suicide, mass shootings, depression, and morbid obesity plague a population that has fallen into profound despair. The deep disillusionment and anger that led to Donald Trump's election, a reaction to the corporate coup d'etat, and the poverty afflicting at least half the country have destroyed the myth of a functioning democracy. Presidential tweets and rhetoric celebrate hate, racism, and bigotry and taunt the weak and the vulnerable. The president, in an address to the United Nations, threatened to obliterate North Korea in an act of genocide. We are worldwide objects of ridicule and hatred. The foreboding for the future is expressed in the rash of dystopian films, motion pictures that no longer perpetuate American virtue and exceptionalism, or the myth of human progress. The loss of this mystique is crippling. It makes it hard to find pliant surrogates to administer the empire, as we have seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. The omnipotence empires project mask the fragility of decayed structures. The expansion of empire beyond the capacity of the homeland to sustain the maintenance and costs of empire makes the system vulnerable, especially during a financial crisis. States that do not administer empires are able to devote more of their resources to domestic prosperity and basic security. But empires have no such option. And when revenues shrink, empires fracture and disintegrate. Without the financing that arises almost organically inside a sovereign nation, empires are famously predatory in their relentless hunt for plunder or profit. Witness the Atlantic slave trade, Belgium's rubber lust in the Congo, British India's opium commerce, the Third Reich's rape of Europe, or the Soviet exploitation of Eastern Europe, McCoy writes. So delicate is their ecology of power that when things start to go truly wrong, empires regularly unravel with unholy speed. Just a year for Portugal, 2 years for the Soviet Union, 8 years for France, 11 years for the Ottomans, 17 for Great Britain, and in all likelihood, just 27 years for the United States, counting from the crucial year 2003. The loss of the dollar as the global reserve currency will instantly make it impossible for the United States to pay for its huge deficits by selling depressed treasury bonds. There will be a massive rise in the cost of imports. Unemployment will explode. Domestic clashes over what McCoy calls insubstantial issues will fuel a dangerous hypernationalism that could morph into an American fascism. The nihilism and rage sweeping across the globe are not generated by warped ideologies or medieval religious beliefs. These destructive forces have their roots in the obliterating of social, cultural, and religious traditions by modernization and the consumer society. The disastrous attempts by the United States to carry out regime change, often through coups and wars, and the utopian neoliberal ideology that has concentrated wealth in the hands of a tiny cabal of corrupt global oligarchs. The rage is directed at discredited elites. This vast global project of social engineering during the last century persuaded hundreds of millions of people, as Pankaj Mishra writes in The Age of Anger, to renounce and often scorn a world of the past that had endured for thousands of years, and to undertake a gamble of creating modern citizens who would be secular, enlightened, cultured, and heroic. The project has been, for all but a handful of global elites, a spectacular failure. The wretched of the earth, as Frantz Fanon called them, have been shorn of any ideological or cultural cohesion. They are cut off from their past. They live in crushing poverty, numbing alienation, hopelessness, and often terror. Mass culture feeds them the tawdry, the violent, the salacious, and the ridiculous. And they are rising up against the forces of modernization, driven by an atavistic fury to destroy the technocratic world that condemns them. This rage is expressed in many forms: Hindu nationalism, proto-fascism, jihadism, the Christian right, anarchic violence, and other beliefs. But the various forms of resistance spring from the same deep wells of global despair. And this resentment is fueling a virulent nationalism, xenophobia, chauvinism, and violence, poisoning the civil discourse and fueling an assault on basic civil liberties. Yet Western elites, rather than accept their responsibility for the global anarchy, self-servingly define the clash as one between the values of the enlightened West and medieval barbarians. They see in the extreme nationalists, religious fundamentalists, and jihadists an inchoate and inexplicable irrationality that can only be quelled with force. They have yet to grasp that the disenfranchised do not hate us for our values. They hate us because of our duplicity, use of indiscriminate industrial violence on their nations and communities, and our hypocrisy. The dispossessed grasp the true message of the West to the rest of the planet. We have everything, And if you try to take it away from us, we will kill you. The more the Western elites are attacked, the more they too retreat into a mythological past, self-glorification, and willful ignorance. The rise of hyper-nationalism, expressed in the absurd slogan, Make America Great Again. The demonization of Muslims, undocumented workers, the growing bellicosity of the state, and the attempt to blame foreign interference is used as a mask to cover the root cause of the discontent, which is profound social inequality, which in the United States is the worst in the industrialized world. Huge segments of the world have been cast aside by globalization, treated in an age of corporate capitalism as human refuse. And their rage is expressed in the kind of anarchic and nihilistic violence that characterized another era of vast inequality, the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. Our rash of mass shootings at schools, churches, concerts, malls, and cinemas, our reaction to the lies fed to workers across the globe by the architects and ideologues of corporate capitalism. These lies, fueled by an arms industry that has saturated the country and the planet with weapons, have spawned homegrown terrorists that have carried out indiscriminate killings at the Boston Marathon, a South Carolina church, Tennessee military facilities, and a Texas Army base. The proponents of globalization promised to lift workers across the planet into the middle class and instill democratic values and scientific rationalism. Religious and ethnic tensions would be alleviated or eradicated. The global marketplace would create a peaceful, prosperous community of nations. All we had to do was get government out of the way and kneel before market demands held up as the ultimate form of progress and rationality. Neoliberalism, in the name of this absurd utopia, stripped away government regulations and laws that once protected the citizen from the worst excesses of predatory capitalism. It created trade agreements that allowed trillions of corporate dollars to be transferred off into offshore accounts to avoid taxation, jobs to flee to sweatshops in China and the global South, where workers live in conditions that replicate slavery. Social service programs and public services were slashed or privatized. Mass culture, including schools and the press, indoctrinated an increasingly desperate population to take part in the global reality show of capitalism. What we were never told was that the game was fixed. We were always condemned to lose. Our manufacturing migrated abroad. General Motors, for example, pays Mexican workers in Monterrey $3 an hour without benefits to make cars and trucks. American workers with unionized wages that came with benefits were cast aside. Wages have declined, our working class is impoverished, endless war is a lucrative business, and the world's wealth has been seized by global oligarchs. Kleptocracies such as the one now installed in Washington brazenly loot the nation's wealth. Democratic idealism is a joke, and we are knit together only by commerce and technology, forces that Hannah Arendt called negative solidarity. Nowhere is this more true than with the modern calls for jihad by self-styled Islamic radicals, most of whom have no religious training and who often come out of the secularized criminal underworld. The jihadist leader Abu Musab Zarqawi, nicknamed the Sheikh of Slaughters in Iraq, was, before he became a radical jihadist, a pimp, a drug dealer, and a heavy drinker. The Afghan-American Omar Mateen reportedly was a frequenter of the nightclub in Orlando, Florida, where he massacred 49 people and had been seen there drunk. Anwar al-Awlaki, who preached jihad and was eventually assassinated by the United States, had a penchant for prostitutes. Abu Muhammad al-Adani, a senior leader of the Islamic State when he was killed, called on Muslims in the West to kill any non-Muslim they encountered. These are his words: smash his head with a rock, or slaughter him with a knife, or run him over with your car, or throw him down from a high place, or choke him, or poison him. These crude, and I would mention deeply anti-Islamic sentiments, have far more in common with Bakunin's propaganda by deed that characterized the nihilism of the late 19th century. It is updated and amplified in videos and live stream feeds and social media. This anarchic violence fills the void left by the destruction of indigenous beliefs, traditions, and rituals. And as Mishra notes, these jihadists represent the death of traditional Islam rather than its resurrection. It is this rage, this resentment at being left behind, that drives terrorist attacks in Paris, London, and now New York. It is what led Timothy McVeigh to bomb the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995, killing 168 people, including 19 children, and injuring 684. And when McVeigh was imprisoned in Florence, Colorado, the prisoner in the adjacent cell was Ramzi Ahmed Youssef, the mastermind of the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. After McVeigh was executed, Youssef commented, "I have never known anyone in my life who has so similar a personality to my own as his." It is becoming harder and harder to distinguish us from our enemies. Trump, given the political, economic, and cultural destruction carried out by neoliberalism, is not an aberration. He is the result of a market society and capitalist democracy that has ceased to function. An angry and alienated underclass is entranced by electronic hallucinations that take the place of literacy. These Americans take a perverse and almost diabolical delight in demagogues such as Trump that expressed contempt for and openly flout the traditional rules and rituals of a power structure that preys upon them. Similar demagogues like Modi have risen up in India, the Philippines, Poland, Hungary, and other states. And this is almost always a characteristic of the final stage of the some 69 empires that have risen and fallen throughout human history. These demagogues and mythologizers, we see them on Fox News and other right-wing outlets, eschew truth for historical and cultural myth. Reinhold Niebuhr called them the blind fanatics of Western civilization, who regard the highly contingent achievements of our culture as the final form and norm of human existence. The unacknowledged reality is that the process of modernization and colonialization has been accompanied by carnage and bedlam. The rapacious appetite of capitalists and imperialists, as Mishra notes, never considered such constraining factors as finite geographical space, degradable natural resources, and fragile ecosystems. And in carrying out this project of global expansion and modernization, no form of coercion or violence was off limits. Terrorist attacks, such as the flying of the hijacked planes into the World Trade Center, illustrate that those who oppose us are products of our moral universe. They have been schooled well in the art of modern warfare. The dramatic explosions, the fireballs, the victims jumping to their deaths, the collapse of the two huge towers in Manhattan were straight out of Hollywood. Where else but from the industrialized world did the suicide hijackers learn that huge explosions and death above a city skyline are a peculiar and effective form of communication? They have mastered the language we taught them. They learned that the use of disproportionate and indiscriminate violence against innocents is a way to make a statement. And we delivered the same incendiary messages in Vietnam. Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense in 1965, defined the saturation bombing of the North, which left hundreds of thousands of civilians dead, as a means of communication to the communist regime in Hanoi. And we speak this language in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Pakistan, Somalia, and through our Saudi proxies in Yemen. The roots of even the worst atrocities carried out by jihadists have their origins in our campaigns to colonize and subdue the rest of the world. It was the French colonists who used waterboarding, a technique inherited from the Nazis, on Algerians. We, like the Soviets, turned psychological torture into a science, one we employ in black sites around the world and in our prison system. ISIS, copying the masters of these dark arts, dressed their Western hostages in Guantanamo's orange suits and turned on smartphone cameras before beheading their victims, the favored form of execution of Muslims by the Crusaders. If we had not destroyed government authority in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria, leaving vast swaths of territory to criminal gangs, warlords, and ad hoc militias, there would have been no vacuum for these radical jihadists to fill. George Santayana foresaw that America's obsessive individualistic culture of competition and mimicry would eventually incite a lava wave of primitive blindness and violence. The inability to be self-critical and self-aware, coupled with a cult of the self, would lead to collective suicide. Karl Shorsky, in Fiend to Sick Vienna, Politics and Culture, wrote that Europe's descent into fascism was inevitable once it cut the cord of consciousness. Once we no longer acknowledge or understand our capacity for evil, once we no longer know ourselves, we become monsters who devour others and finally devour our own. We are paying the price for discarding hundreds of millions of people onto the dung heap of history. Unable to understand and cope with reality, we wage endless wars in the name of democracy and Western civilization, which engender more martyrs to fuel the violence we seek to crush. We are afflicted by what Albert Camus called auto-intoxication, the malignant secretion of one's preconceived impotence against the enclosure of the self. And until this autotoxication is addressed, the rage and violence at home and abroad will expand as we stumble towards a global apocalypse. This slow motion march towards apocalypse is assured. If we refuse to confront the ecocide we are carrying out on the planetary systems that sustain human life. Seas and rivers are being poisoned and emptied of their stocks of fish. Wildfires, droughts, flooding, monster hurricanes, typhoons, and tsunamis, along with soaring temperatures and the evaporation of the polar ice sheets, along with glaciers, ravage the planet. This ecocide exacerbates the breakdown of social structures, fuels the mass migration of the displaced and refugees, which in turn creates more political instability. Unchecked, these forces will lead in many parts of the globe to complete systems breakdown. The greatest existential crisis of our time is to at once accept the tragic reality before us and find the courage to resist. It is to acknowledge that the world as we know it will become harsher and more difficult, that human suffering will expand, but that we can, if we fight back, perhaps reconfigure our lives and our society to mitigate the worst savagery, dramatically reduce our carbon footprint, and save ourselves from complete annihilation. The power elites will do nothing to save us. To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic, Howard Zinn wrote. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, when people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do not, and if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presents. And to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory. This makes resistance a moral and an existential imperative. Resistance entails suffering. It requires self-sacrifice. It accepts that we may be destroyed. It is not rational. It is not about the pursuit of happiness. It is about the pursuit of freedom. Resistance accepts that even if we fail, there is an inner freedom that comes with defiance. And perhaps this is the only freedom and true happiness we will ever know. To resist evil is the highest achievement of human life. It is the supreme act of love. It is to carry the cross, as the theologian James Cone reminds us, and to be acutely aware that what we are carrying is also what we will die upon. Most of those who resist, Sitting Bull, Emma Goldman, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, are defeated, at least in the cold calculation of the powerful. And the final and perhaps most important quality of resistance, as Cone writes, is that it inverts the world's value system. Hope rises up out of defeat. Those who resist stand, regardless of the cost, with the crucified. This is their magnificence. And it is their power. The seductive inducements to conformity, money, fame, prizes, generous grants, huge book contracts, hefty lecture fees, important academic and political positions, and a public platform are scorned by those who resist. The rebel does not define success the way the elites define success. Those who resist refuse to kneel before the idols of mass culture and the power elites. They are not trying to get rich. They do not want to be part of the inner circle of the powerful. They accept that when you stand with the oppressed, you get treated like the oppressed. The inversion of the world's value system makes freedom possible. Those who resist are free not because they have attained many things or high positions, but because they have so few needs. They sever the shackles used to keep most people in bondage. And this is why the elites fear them. The elites can crush them physically, but they cannot buy them off. The power elites attempt to discredit those who resist. They force them to struggle to make an income. They push them to the margins of society. They write them out of the official narrative. They deny them the symbols of status. They use the compliant liberal class to paint them as unreasonable and utopian. But resistance is not fundamentally political. It is cultural. It is about finding meaning and expression in the transcendent, in the incongruities of life. Music, poetry, theater, and art sustain resistance by giving expression to the nobility of rebellion against overwhelming force. What the ancient Greeks called fortuna, which can never ultimately be overcome. Art celebrates the freedom and dignity of those who defy malignant evil. Victory is not inevitable, or at least not victory as defined by the powerful. Yet in every act of rebellion, we are free. It was the raw honesty of the blues, spirituals, work chants that made it possible for African Americans to endure. Power is a poison. It does not matter who wields it. The rebel, for this reason, is an eternal heretic. He or she will never fit into any system. The rebel stands with the powerless, and there will always be powerless people. There will always be injustice, and the rebel will always be an outsider. And resistance requires eternal vigilance. The moment the powerful are no longer frightened, the moment the glare of the people is diverted and movements let down their guard, the moment the ruling elites are able to use propaganda and censorship to hide their aims, the gains made by resistors roll backward. We have steadily been stripped of everything that organized men and women who rose up in defiance and were purged, demonized, and killed by the capitalist elites achieved with the New Deal. The victories of African Americans who paid with their bodies and blood in making possible the Great Society and ending legal segregation also have been reversed. The corporate state makes no pretense of addressing social inequality or white supremacy. It practices only the politics of vengeance. It uses coercion, fear, violence, police terror, and mass incarceration as its primary form of social control. Our cells of resistance will have to be rebuilt from scratch. The corporate state, however, is in trouble. It has no credibility. All the promises of the free market, globalization, trickle-down economics have been exposed as a lie, an empty ideology used to satiate greed. And the elites have no counter-argument to their anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist critics. The attempt to blame the electoral insurgencies in the United States' two ruling political parties on Russian interference rather than massive social inequality is a desperate ploy. The courtiers and the corporate press are working feverishly day and night to distract us from reality. The moment the elites are forced to acknowledge social inequality is the root of our discontent, is the moment they are forced to acknowledge their role in orchestrating this inequality. The U.S. government, subservient to corporate power, has become a burlesque. The last vestiges of the rule of law are evaporating. The kleptocrats are pillaging and looting like barbarian hordes. Programs instituted to protect the common good, public education, welfare, and environmental regulations are being dismantled. The bloated military sucking the marrow out of the nation is unassailable. Poverty is a nightmare for half the people. Poor people of color are gunned down with impunity in the streets. Our prison system is filled with the destitute, and presiding over the chaos and dysfunction is a political P.T. Barnum, a president who, while we are being fleeced, offers up one bizarre distraction after another, like Barnum's Fiji mermaid. There are no shortage of artists, intellectuals, and writers, from Martin Buber and George Orwell to James Baldwin, who warned us that this dystopian era was fast approaching. But in our Disneyfied world of intoxicating and endless images, cult of the self, and willful illiteracy, we did not listen. Soren Kierkegaard argued that it was the separation of intellect from emotion, from empathy, that doomed Western civilization. For the soul has no role in a technocratic society. The communal has been shattered, the concept of the common good obliterated. Greed is celebrated, the individual is a god, the celluloid image is reality. The artistic and intellectual forces that make transcendence and the communal possible are belittled or ignored. The basest lusts are celebrated as forms of identity and self-expression. Progress is defined exclusively by technological and material advancement. And this creates a collective despair and anxiety that feeds and is fed by glitter, noise, and the false promises of consumer culture idols. The desperate or the despair grows ever worse, but we never acknowledge our existential dread. As Kierkegaard understood, the specific character of despair is precisely this. It is unaware of being despair. Those who resist are relentlessly self-critical. They ask the hard questions that mass culture, which promises an unachievable eternal youth, fame, and financial success, deflects us from asking. What does it mean to be born? What does it mean to live? What does it mean to die? How do we live a life of meaning? What is justice? What is truth? What is beauty? What does our past say about our presence? How do we defy radical evil? We are in the grip of what Kierkegaard called sickness unto death, the numbing of the soul by despair that leads to moral and physical debasement. Those who are ruled by rational abstractions and an aloof intellectualism, Kierkegaard argued, are as depraved as those who succumb to hedonism, cravings for power, violence, and predatory sexuality. We achieve salvation when we accept the impediments of the body and the soul, the limitations of being human, yet despite these limitations seek to do good. This burning honesty, which means we always exist on the cusp of despair, leaves us, in Kierkegaard's words, in fear and trembling. We struggle not to be brutes while acknowledging we can never be angels. We must act and then ask for forgiveness. We must be able to see our face in the face of the oppressor. Paul Tillich did not use the word sin to mean an act of immorality. He, like Kierkegaard, defined sin as estrangement. For Tillich, it was our deepest existential dilemma. Sin was our separation from the forces that give us ultimate meaning and purpose in life. This separation fosters alienation, anxiety, meaninglessness, and despair that are preyed upon by mass culture. As long as we fold ourselves inward, embrace a perverted hyper-individualism that is defined by selfishness and narcissism, we will never overcome this estrangement. We will be separated from ourselves, from others, and from the sacred. Resistance is not only about the battling of the forces of darkness. It is about becoming a whole and complete human being. It is about overcoming estrangement. It is about the capacity to love. It is about honoring the sacred. It is about dignity. It is about sacrifice. It is about courage, and it is about being free. Resistance to radical evil is the pinnacle of human existence. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. And thank you all again for being here. We're going to do a question and answer session. And if you want to ask a question, you can start lining up here at this mic. Depending on how long the line is, it'll go this way into the community room. It's a lot to think about. It's scary, you know. Bringing Chris here, it feels like group therapy, right? We're figuring out what is going on in this world and how can we work together? What can we do to make it better? Can we make it better? And that's what we're doing here at the Sanctuary every day. Again, the radio station is a huge opportunity to amplify all of that. You can help us do that. You can help us by joining us on the air, becoming a volunteer, and by donating. Again, we need $30,000, and we need it quickly so we can build transmitters in Albany and Schenectady and be bringing bright, intelligent, independent thinking voices that are not driven by corporate interests to the airwaves. The airwaves are an extremely powerful medium. People are tuned in and listening. It's intimate. And it's an opportunity. It's one of the few places where, I've said this before, where in this day and age, you might hear an opinion that you don't already have. So please consider donating to this right now. If you're thinking about donating $50, think about donating $1,000. If that is terrifying and you can't do that and it's just no, bring it down to $250. Try to stay there. So again, we're gonna. If please stand up and line up if you have a question. Is this the line? Okay, good. So we got people here. Hi, Ingrid. In the meantime, I'm gonna have people stationed along the sign, and we're gonna pass a jar. It's, you know, it's worship here. It's sacred. It's spiritual. So I hope you'll contribute. Thank you. And thank you to Chris for handing me $100 just, you know, before he started speaking. So.
It was a pleasure listening to you, and I. Every time I come to these kinds of events, I always have the same question that I've never asked it, so I hope I'm verbalizing it. I would bet $100 that less than 1% of the people here are consider themselves like Republican or conservative. So when I come to these events, I keep seeing the same, you know, my group of people, you know, the same kind of people, and I'm wondering, you talked about people feeling disenfranchised and betrayed by the system and by the elites, and that's the kind of people that supposedly voted for Trump, and your message is recurring in your writing. Of, you know, coming together and focusing on helping each other. I feel like when you say that, I always think of the people that voted for Trump, you know, the lower class, you know, poor, uneducated, whatever, you know, there's that sector of the population is, and I'm not sure I'm saying it correctly, but what can we do to bring that the power of those people so they feel like they're part of us, like we're all together trying to struggle in this world against the big forces of capitalism and you know,
well, we
the
have,
rich.
We have to organize around specific issues that make their lives better. $15 minimum wage, universal health care. As Saul Alinsky said, there are no permanent allies, there's only permanent power. And that means reaching out to people whose political views we find distasteful and even repugnant. But as Rosa Luxemburg understood, conversion takes place through acts of empathy that are carried out to people who are not your natural allies. And when you organize around those concrete issues, that is the starting point for political consciousness and political awakening. And one of the things that does disturb me is the kind of dismissive tone towards that disenfranchised white working class. I don't defend what the flag-waving Confederates do in the streets of Charlottesville or anywhere else, but they are also victims. And I would all encourage you to go back and read the great book, Brother to a Dragonfly, by Will Campbell, who had been the Baptist minister who, and in fact, that picture of walking the girls to school in Little Rock for desegregation, he's right next to them in the South, but became the chaplain to the Ku Klux Klan, in a sense that the state seeks to keep us polarized and divided. And we're not going to gain traction by speaking to them about their mythological past, and because they've retreated into the world of magical thinking like the Christian right. We're going to begin to break down that ideology by concretely addressing those forces that create that despair.
Chris, my name's Ted Hartman. I'm from this area. And I think anyone from this area would tell you that certainly on a local level, the Democratic Party has a very strong hold over Albany, Troy, Schenectady. There's been machine politics in this area for decades. And my question to you is, I think like you, I think we'll all agree that the corporate powers have taken over the Republican and Democratic parties. However, it seems to me that like a far-right white nationalist element has taken over the Republican Party. Is it? Do you think it's even worth our effort or time to try to insert socialists into the Democratic Party and to try to take over that party, because they do have the mechanisms of power? Even if they're not expressing our views, is it worth our time and effort to try to insert ourselves into those and hijack sort of their power mechanisms, because they've got voter rolls, they've got organization. I don't think all of the people that voted Republican last time were people who were necessarily white nationalists, but they voted for people who are white nationalists. And so is it possible for us to take over the Democratic Party, insert socialists, and then use their mechanisms of power to try to enact what we want to go?
No. The Democratic Party is a creation of Wall Street. Those who are in power, Pelosi, Schumer, are creatures of that system. They know that if they were, for instance, to institute true campaign finance reform, they'd be out of a job. And we are watching the purges now within the DNC of the Bernie Sanders supporters, because they would rather go down than create an open system which would knock them off their perches or their platforms of power. Politics is a game of fear. I mean, the last liberal president we had was Richard Nixon, not because he was a liberal or had any integrity or heart, but because he was frightened of movements. And we have to rebuild those movements. That's our goal. And we have to hold fast to moral imperatives and not allow the establishment, including the Democratic Party, to buy us off. So you had the beginnings of a very widespread anti-war movement at the inception of the Iraq War. And what happened in 2004, they went into hiatus to elect John Kerry, who assured us that he wouldn't have pulled out of Fallujah. And this is a big mistake. You know, there's that great scene in Kissinger's memoirs, Don't Buy the Book, where Nixon and Kissinger are looking out the window. I think it's 71 or something. There's a huge anti-war demonstration, and the White House has put empty city buses in a ring around the White House to protect themselves. And Nixon's wringing his hand and says, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. And that's where we want people in power to be.
Hi, Chris. Dan Lander here. I'm curious and was very interested in kind of the utility of the word resistance that you're using through this. And my question is, if resistance is such a fundamental kind of experience as a human, does it kind of presuppose that there will always be something to resist against, which is equally as fundamental to our experience?
Yes. I mean, there's that great passage in Vasily Grossman's magnificent work, Life and Fate, one of probably the greatest work of fiction of the 20th century out of Russia, where he talks about the power of human kindness. I'm going to read it, but I don't want to butcher it. I don't have my iPhone, luckily. Where's Megan? Is Megan around? Maybe can she find it for me? It's called Life and Fate. All you have to do is put in Vasily Grossman, Life and Fate, Chris Hedges, and you'll get it. But I think that, yes, I come out of Calvin. I have a very dark view. I was a war correspondent. I have a very dark view of human nature. I think evil will always be there. And it is an eternal battle on our part to resist. And, you know, I tell the story of, since I'm close to Schoharie, of my dad, who was a Presbyterian minister in Schoharie, all white, as you know, farm community. He was very outspoken about the civil rights, supporting the civil rights movement. This was a time when Martin Luther King was probably one of the most hated men in America in rural white enclaves like Schoharie County. He had been a sergeant in North Africa in World War II, but he came back from the war a pacifist and was very active in opposing the Vietnam War and the issue for which he got pushed out of the church. He was very outspoken about gay rights. His youngest brother was gay, my uncle, and my father understood the pain of being a gay man in the 50s and 60s. And that, I was 8, 9. Very important time for me because he taught me that you're not rewarded for positions of virtue. In fact, you're usually punished for them. And what finally pushed the institutional church over the edge was his outspokenness about gay rights. And at the time, I was a undergraduate at Colgate. And my father, by the way, there was no gay GBLT organization at Colgate, so my dad actually brought the gay speakers down to the campus to have meetings with students, of which I would join. And finally, and he kept saying that you have to build a public organization. And finally, because they were too frightened to come out of the closet, he came down one day and took me out to lunch and told me that even though I wasn't gay, I had to found the GBLT Alliance at Colgate, which I did. It met every... And I would go into the dining hall at breakfast, lunch, or dinner. The guy would check off the my card, hand it back, and go, faggot. So when the church told him to stop, he responded by holding an Easter service for the GBLT community at that time in the city of Syracuse, where he had a church. And he said, marriage is a sacrament. It is not a reward for being a heterosexual. And any church that refuses to honor the sacrament of marriage does not deserve to call itself Christian. And he was out. Years later, after being the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, I was publicly denouncing Bush's call to invade Iraq. I was booed off of a commencement stage, lynched by right-wing media, called in to the New York Times and given a formal written reprimand and told I was no longer allowed to speak about the war in Iraq. And I realized, and I'd been there 15 years, it wasn't an easy moment. No one wants to lose their job. But I realized at that moment that I could muzzle myself in service to my career. But to do so would be to betray my dad. And I quit. And when I walked out the door of that building, for the first time in my life, I articulated what it was my father had given me. And that was freedom. I didn't need the New York Times to tell me who I was. I knew who I was. I was my father's son. And in the Christian faith, we call that resurrection. And that is the power of resistance, which perhaps even my father didn't see. And it will always be there, and those acts of resistance are what Father Daniel Berrigan told me when he defined faith as the belief that the good draws to it the good, even if all the empirical evidence around us says otherwise. The Buddhists call it karma. But I've seen rebellion. Eastern Europe. I was speaking at dinner about watching the Velvet Revolution. I was every night in the Magic Lantern Theater with Václav Havel and Dinsmore and all the people who would inherit the government. And the walls of Prague that winter were filled with posters of the Charles University student Jan Palach, who, to protest the Soviet invasion in 1968, had gone to Wenceslas Square and lit himself on fire and died 4 days later from his burns. His funeral, which was a non-event, was never covered by the state media, was broken up by the police when his grave became a shrine. His body was exhumed, cremated, his ashes were given to his mother, and she was told she was not allowed to rebury them. And 2 weeks after the communist government fell, 10,000 people marched to Red Army Square and renamed it Jan Palach Square. I was in Wenceslas Square when Marta Kubashova, the great singer who had sung the anthem of defiance, a prayer for Marta that was broadcast out over the airwaves in 1968. And after the imposition of the Soviet-backed government, her recording stock was destroyed. She spent the intervening years working on an assembly line in a toy factory. She was banned from the airwaves. There were 500,000 people in Wenceslas Square that night. It was snowing when she walked out on that balcony and began to sing the prayer for Marta, and every Czech in that crowd knew every word. That is the power of resistance, the moral power of resistance, that even for all those people you think are asleep, somewhere hear it.
Thank you, Chris, for being here.
Did we find Megan or maybe? Okay, I have to read. It's one of my favorite quotes. It's from Vasily Grossman, and it's from his book Life and Fate. He was probably the premier war correspondent in the Soviet Union. You read any account of Stalingrad because he was in the front lines. They're going to be quoting Grossman, and at the end of the war, he carried War and Peace with him. He went all the way from Stalingrad to Berlin. And he came to the belief that any form of totalitarianism, any form of utopian belief, whether it's communism or fascism, is evil. And he waited until Stalin died, attempted to publish the novel. It wasn't palatable. It was seized. He became a non-person. He died, I think, in 64. And then it was until 1980, the manuscript was smuggled out and published in Europe. And I think it's one of the finest books of the 20th century. Megan, you better come up here. I'm like useless with these things. Yeah. Okay, we got it. And this is the quote from him. My faith has been tempered in hell. My faith has emerged from the flames of the crematoria, from the concrete of the gas chamber. I have seen that it is not man who is impotent in the struggle against evil, but the power of evil that is impotent in the struggle against man. The powerlessness of kindness, of senseless kindness, is the secret of its immortality. It can never be conquered. The more stupid, the more senseless, the more helpless it may seem, the vaster it is. Evil is impotent before it. The prophets, religious leaders, reformers, social and political leaders are impotent before it. This dumb, blind love is man's meaning. Human history is not the battle of good struggling to overcome evil. It is a battle fought by a great evil, struggling to crush a small kernel of human kindness. But if what is human in human beings has not been destroyed even now, then evil will never conquer.
Thanks for joining us today on Wake Up Call. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope to see you again. My name is Bernard White, and until next time, stay strong, pay close attention, and never give up.
There, rivers of dreams flowing through the heartache of this place.